She's lying on the bed. And she's thriving. Ah! 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 And the guy comes in and he's like, oh no, and she's like, ah! And the bed's moving and she's moving. And he walks over and he picks up the automatic bed adjuster and turns it off. And she's like, oh, thanks.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Dark Desserts from the Movie Chefs. I'm your host, Tebs. Here is my executive host, Corm. Hello, Corm. Mad at me because I'm late.
Not mad.
I'm a little late, all right? Look, we all have
To be fair, I'm late, but you then became late as well, which, well, you know.
I think we're both late considering this episode is our Halloween episode, recording it one week to the day after Halloween. But this is our series of Dark Desserts where we look at the darker side of the movie business. We've done the death of Natalie Wood, the murder of Natalie Wood in the past. This week we are discussing The Curse of the Exorcist. First question, is there a curse?
I genuinely don't think so. I think it's one of these things where when a myth builds up, like the Poltergeist myth, when the myth builds up about a movie, it kind of makes it more kind of appealable. But I think like The Exorcist, especially in the UK, The Exorcist has this mythos around it. You know, it has this kind of video nasty experience. You know, it was banned in the UK up until 1999. You know, it was banned. Nobody could fucking see it. The only way you're going to see it was if it was an rental copy from America, and nobody would have an NTSC fucking VHS player in the fucking 80s and 90s. So I mean, that kind of built up the kind of scenario of a curse, you know, built from the set on The Exorcist.
Well, this is obviously, we are talking the 1973 film The Exorcist by William Friedkin, starring Max von Sydow, Linda Blair, Ellen Burstyn. It is one of these, I think it's obviously one of the first Oscar-nominated horror films. So obviously people recognised its quality as such. But this is based on the novel by William Peter Blatty, The Exorcist. And I think a lot of the aura about this, and the one film that sort of jumped to mind as I was reading about this, was how The Exorcist had that same kind of I had a really good word for it written down, I haven't, you know, sort of mass hysteria kind of thing. So yeah. similar to the way when the Blair Witch Project came out, people said, do not go see this film in a cinema. If you do, keep your feet on the floor at all times. You know, you'll get motion sickness, or the horror might be too much for you. And you'd say that enough to people, and people will believe it. And all the YouTube videos I was watching of people who come out of The Exorcist, I mean, that's one of the first part of the curse, then. One of the first notes about this curse is that it was making people ill while watching it. Yeah. And a lot of the people they seemed to be speaking to were very religious people or young girls.
Just say it. Mental Christians.
Catholics. They were speaking to a lot of Catholics.
Well, what people that don't realize as well is that, well, The Exorcist, and I'm going to do quotation marks, I know this is an audio medium, I'm going to do quotation marks, is based on a true story. It was based on the story of a guy called Roland Doe, so his name has obviously been taken away because he was actually quite young when it happened, and it happened in the 40s in Washington, D.C. Now, the story obviously goes, I'm going to be very, very cryptic about this, and I'm going to be very, very plain. I have listened to a few podcasts on it. So this young guy, Roland Doe, basically writhed in the bed, projectile vomited, spoke in tongue, spoke in different voices. You know, he was way too young to be doing this kind of stuff. The Catholic Church got involved, and they basically thought that he was a mental case. But then they realized that they could be dealing with something, you know, non-secular, the devil, demons, you know, ghosts and ghouls. So they started basically giving him round the clock fucking, you know, crosses and prayers and stuff like that there. And that's when the kind of exorcism, you know, boom kind of started. William Peter Blatty was around that time. He was a writer back then in the 50s. You know, he started hearing about this. He got speaking to a few priests about Roland Doe. I believe William Peter Blatty is one of only a handful of people that have actually read the Catholic doctrine on the actual incident itself. If you believe all that stuff, there are a few diaries that are, you know, around, but most of them are being suppressed, again, quotation marks, suppressed by the Catholic Church because they don't want all this stuff getting out. I don't understand why, because if it was fucking real, would you not be more impressed that you kind of saved this person, you got it out? But at the end of the day,
it kind of backs up everything you've been saying forever.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, look, here's proof. If there's proof of the devil, then there's proof of God. You know, we've been telling you about this for years, and here it is. I don't know. But this,
I put this down more like the autism argument that people have. You know, autism was not around in the 80s. Autism was not around in the 90s. No, autism was around then. It has been around for many a year. Autism has always been around. You know, but it just didn't have a name. You know, it didn't have an actual word to explain what was going on. You know, you look back, and I look back on my childhood, and I look back on my classrooms. I can tell you about four or five people who are on the spectrum. You know, you can see it. You can see that going backwards. And I think it's more towards that kind of scenario where it's a mental health issue rather than a spiritual, the devil's inside me issue. And, you know, what did they used to do back then? They put them in a straitjacket and kicked them into an asylum.
Well, the case of Roland Doe started off with he was raised by his aunt Harriet, who was a spiritualist and taught him many things, including how to use a Ouija board. And the Ouija board, the use in this, it was always one of those things. It was like somebody whipped that out at a sleepover, a party, or something.
Or you made your own Ouija board. That was always the best one. You made your own Ouija board, then you used like a fag packet to fucking to go and do the words. Oh.
Back of a cornflakes box, and you're writing all the letters out and yes or no and stuff.
And but Roland Doe, the Roland Doe case. If you believe everything, and the rumors are that he came out the other side. One day he just woke up. And he was absolutely fine. The demons were gone. And if you're to believe everything, he went on to work for NASA. That's one of the rumors that I heard. So if you're to believe it, that it's actually a real thing, and this person got over their mental illness, sorry, their demonic possession, then they went on and then became, I don't know, you know, somebody who built rockets.
Well, there is a lot of argument to say it's more than just a mental illness. There were several instances, such as scratches appearing on the young boy's body. Could have been self-inflicted, I know, but I'm just going with it here. They also noticed water dripping inexplicably from pipes. His behaviour would change. He was calm and normal during the day. But at night, he was, when he settled for bed, his behaviour would be strange with screaming and wild outbursts. He'd sometimes enter a trance-like state and start making sounds in a guttural voice. The priests also say they saw objects mysteriously flying in the boy's presence, and he would react violently to any sacred object presented by the attending Jesuits. At one point during the week-long exorcism, one of the priests reported an X appearing scratches on Roland's chest, which the priest signified as the number 10. Also, a pitchfork-shaped pattern of red lines moved from the boy's thighs, snaking down to his ankles. These apparently happened every night. And again, they led it to assumption of possession of demons.
Yeah, but people back then thought that TV was magic. You know what I mean? So anything that fucking that appears to go a little bit weird, it was basically either the devil or magic. So, you know, you know, let's be honest, a lot of these cases and stuff have been, you think about the fairy case. Remember that fairy case in England where them kids said that they were being visited by fairies, and all of a sudden, two guys came out and said that they had kind of come up with the 1940s or 1930s version of Photoshop and put fucking, you know, fairies in it, a la Loch Ness Monster, you know, all that shit about Nessie, you know, that famous picture of Nessie's head kind of breaking the water, and everybody's like, oh, Loch Ness Monster exists. And then in the late 90s, two guys came out and went, yeah, that was us. We just put a whole fucking pile of mold onto a raft and put it out in the water. You're like, yeah, yay, okay. But I think people a lot are like emotionally invested or sometimes monetarily invested in these actual things being real. And I think that's probably what the Catholic Church is kind of hoping on.
Yeah, and I think the movie studio as well, because no doubt this, I mean, this made around 400 million at the box office. Now, in the early 70s, that's the equivalent today of about 1.5 billion. You know, that is a huge top, you know, massive film of the time. For an X-rated horror film, that was incredible. And they would have relied on spreading this word of this true life exorcism to stoke fear and intrigue. And, you know, anything, any opportunity a film gets to put at the beginning based on a true event, based on a true story, and people will lap it up because they know that there is a possibility that what they're watching actually happened. Now, Friedkin, when he got the novel, him and William Peter Blatty wrote the screenplay. A lot of the similarities, I mean, they did move the entirety of the story to Washington, D.C. For the film The Exorcist, as opposed to the majority of the exorcism took place in St. Louis, and then Roland was moved to Georgetown later in February 1949. The spitting, the scratches, the cursing, all very similar to what Roland had experienced. Apparently, this article I'm reading was very specific to say his head never turned around 360 degrees. he didn't vomit green, and he didn't masturbate with a crucifix. But apart from that, so there's a lot of
You know, you look at some of this as well. You know, you look at some of the scenes in The Exorcist, and you can understand why, you know, people like Mary Whitehouse went after it. You know, you can like, you're looking at it now, and what was Reagan, 13?
12, yeah.
Yeah, and having a 12-year-old girl on a bed, you know, with a crucifix doing some things like that, that's quite out there. You know, there are scenes, you know, obviously that are viscerally, you know, affecting as well. You know, that scene where Max von Sydow walks outside the window for the first time, you know, and that's that famous shot that comes in of the light from the window when he's standing looking up, you know, viscerally, that gives you chills. You know, that gives you the hair stands in the back of your neck. And then, of course, as soon as fucking Tubular Bell starts as well, it's kind of like, oh, fuck me, this is not right. This is everything. It's a perfect storm. It kind of comes in this movie. You know, there's so many sounds that are there. There's so many visuals that are there. There's so many, you know, musical tones that are just pitch perfect, that it just stirs emotions. And I think that's potentially why it is remembered as one of the scariest movies of all time, because it is. It's awkward. It's an awkward movie. You know, it gives you the heebie-jeebies.
One of the, I mean, you mentioned there about Linda Blair's performance, and yes, she was a young girl at the time of recording, and a few of the bits I've watched, it was, yes, there were lots of accidents and deaths on this film, but it is a piece of, you know, it is movie making. Mercedes McCambridge, that did the voice of, you know, the demon, Linda Blair, you know, she was one part of this curse. Again, a lot of this curse comes down to William Friedkin being fucking awful by the sounds of it. She decided to get the perfect voice for the demon. She would strap herself into a chair and drink and smoke. Now, this is a woman who'd been sober for a number of years, but she needed to drink and smoke to get the voice right for this demon. And she would chain herself in, and she would have a priest with her during recording because she was getting drunk every day, and it was going against what she needed as a person. There's a lot of other.
But what a voice though! like if you take, and I think again, this is why The Exorcist kind of evokes so many emotions, because they got near enough everything right. They got the sound right.
Yeah.
They got the music right. They got the cinematography right. They got the acting right. They got the voices right. You know, the way that even Linda Blair, you know, acts in this movie, she's not acting. You know, she is not acting. She is a 12-year-old girl, you know, in this situation. The scenes where, you know, she's going in for the brain scan and stuff like that there, and she's talking to Ellen Burstyn, you know, they're just having a conversation as a mother and a daughter, and it's just so fucking believable. And, you know, then, you know, you break that into, you've got the what's his name? Jason Miller as Father Karras.
Yeah.
You know, you have his kind of raw kind of emotions, you know, between his secular brain, his emotions towards his mother. You know, you have all this stuff that's just so weird. And then you have the backdrop of this dirty kind of, it's not New York, you can, no. but it is dirtier and grittier than New York. You know, it is a Washington DC, it's Georgetown that is just so nasty looking.
What got me about this, about Georgetown and the setting, is yes, it looks lovely, the beautiful white painted windows and the sash windows and the French doors, and it's obviously an upper part of town. You know, I'm not watching this thinking it's like Harlem or Compton, or, you know, I think this is a very well-to-do part of Washington, but it's what goes on behind those doors, and the way that this was lit and the way that it was staged really made you believe that this is one dark, scary part of town that you do not want to be in. And during the day, it's beautiful. Actors and politicians and priests walk around without a care in the world. But behind those doors and what's going on, it was very unnerving. You say Linda Blair wasn't acting. Well, no, a lot of the time she wasn't. And this goes back to, we talk about the curse, and we'll say, you know, we'll start with injuries that happened on set. Well, Linda Blair was injured extensively on set. For the time when she was first sort of falling deeper into possession after the just before the masturbation scene, where she's being thrown around on the bed, that was the special effects guy that had come up with a large iron metal plate that would sit over her back, and she'd be strapped in and with a nightgown over the top, and he would be firing up the pneumatics in the background, and he would be throwing this girl around on the bed, lifting her up and slamming her back down, and she's saying, stop, it hurts. That's not acting. That's her saying, I'm in fucking pain right now. And Ellen Burstyn was in the situation where just before the wardrobe sort of gets moved over to her after she gets punched away, again, she was on a roping rig where she was dragged across the room. And she said, Bill, you know, William, if you hurt me, I'm gone. You know, you're going to hurt me doing this. And he kind of gives a wink to his special effects guy, and they go, oh, I wonder how much we can get away with here. That's not a curse. That's two men that push things way too far for the sake of a film. Now, does it look good? Yeah. Would it have had the same impact without her being thrown across the room, you know, just dragged? I think it would have looked just the same. It wouldn't have affected that film at all.
I think Friedkin is in the kind of mold of directors who were complete Hitlers back in that day. You know, you look at stories of Alfred Hitchcock on the set of The Birds, you know, when he absolutely tortured Tippi Hedren. You know, he literally tortured her. You look at what Kubrick did to most of his actresses. You know, he fucking terrorized them. And I remember that story that you're talking about there with Ellen Burstyn when she was pulled. And the thing about Friedkin is that Friedkin always left the injury scenes in the movie. He always left. That was the scene that he always put in the movie. I think I told a story a few weeks ago, and it was genuinely about the slap, you know, to an actor just before the, you know, it's your friend. And it's the scene where when he falls out, when Father Karras kills himself out the window.
Yeah, this is him. Is it William O'Malley is playing Father Dyer?
And
he's giving him the last rites over his body. Yeah. And
Friedkin was just completely, listen, this is your fucking friend. You're giving your friend his last rites, blah, blah, blah. And he couldn't get the scene right. And then he just walked over to him. And it was just, he said to the cinematographer, listen, keep filming, like keep filming. And he walked over to him and just wham, just right across the face. And he's just like, right, go. And then he started doing the scenes. And the scene where he's given the last rites and you see his hand visibly shaking, that's literally after getting a full suction slap from William Friedkin. Yeah. And that's the scene that they kept in.
And Friedkin as well, he didn't adhere himself to Jason Miller, because while there was one scene where he was trying to get an emotion of shock and terror from Karras, and he fires a gun on set, yep, right next to the actor. And,
well known for firing a shotgun, yeah.
And at that time, Jason Miller turns around to him and says, for fuck's sake, I'm an actor. I can act. That's what I'm here to do. You don't need to do this crazy shit to get me acting the way you want me to. Like I say, there are deaths associated with this. Now, it seems to be that people sort of put this one together because there is a curse of the Exorcist. People have died who have taken part in this film. I mean, this film's nearly 50 years old. You know, we are on, let's just say, I'm not surprised that a lot of the people who were in this have died, but how, you know, when they died after being in the film, I'm not too sure. You know, it sounds, I mean, well, Jack McGowan, who played Burke Dennings, he died in 1973, January 1973, shortly after this film was released, due to complications with influenza. We've got the guy who played Dr. Klein, Barton Heyman. He died in 1996 through heart failure. Then we've got the obviously notable ones with Linda Blair. Lee J. Cobb, who played the lieutenant in 1976, 3 years after the film came out, died age 64 of a heart attack. The woman who played Karras's mother, quite an important character, I think, who we spend very little time with, but she's probably one of the main. Vasilika Maliaros, she died in February 1973 due to natural causes. Mercedes McCambridge, who we've mentioned, who was the voice of the demon, she did die in 2004 of trouble, of her heart, excuse me, of natural causes, heart trouble. Jason Miller, 2001 at 62 years old, and then Max von Sydow recently. I mean,
it's tenuous, like it's tenuous. You know,
if it was in like 6 months of the film coming out, I mean, The Omen, The Omen, I think as well, you know, you could piece, but then again, I could probably go to, I don't know, I'm not going to try and think of it, but you could probably pick a couple of comedies from the mid 80s,
yeah,
and go, he's died, you know, the Curse of the Addams Family movie, true. You know what I mean? It's like, it can be done. Yeah, so look, a lot of people have died in association with this, but we're talking about curses. Go on.
But I think some of the curse thing comes to the stuff that's on the set as well, because the set burnt down. You know, the house that they were filming, and like, it burnt down. So apparently it was a bird that flew into an electric box, and it burnt the set down. I remember watching that.
It burnt the whole set down, apart from the room where the exorcist was happening. The exorcism was taking place. None of that was touched.
Yeah.
Now, the fact that it was like 3 degrees and freezing cold.
Yeah, that's just going to say that as well, because in that Mark Kermode documentary, right, basically, William Friedkin kept the temperature in that room to a minus. So the likelihood of the only room that's not burnt down is the room that's in a minus temperature and has ice on the fucking walls. I would say that probably would be the room that wouldn't burn down. Like, but you know, I think it's just because of all the video nasty. I think it's all the Mary Whitehouse. It's all the, you know, Evil Dead fucking connections. It's all this different stuff that comes around it that it gets its mythos. You know, let's be brutally honest about The Exorcist. Exorcist is a fucking masterpiece of a movie. Like it is one of the, you know, you can probably think off the top of your head piles of movies that are an absolute masterpiece, that are just from start to finish, it knows exactly what it's doing. For the scenes in Iraq at the start of The Exorcist are as eerie and unsettling as the scenes with Linda Blair as the demon in the bedroom. And, you know, for for a scene or for scenes at the start of a movie that are based in a desert and they're looking for, you know, a monolith, they're looking for a statue or stuff like that there. That shouldn't be eerie, but it's the music, it's the sound, it's the acting, it's the, you know, the destination, it's everything that's involved in the Exorcist that just makes it so fucking eerie.
I think they just caught on to that, because again, if you made this film nowadays, you get a film like The Conjuring, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, Blair Witch Project. I keep going back to that, but it seems to be the certain times during film's history where horror films have kind of put a stake in, excuse the pun, Nosferatu back in 1920, whatever. I mean, King Kong was considered a horror film at one point at the early times. Then you've got, you know, films like The Exorcist in the 70s, Blair Witch in the 90s, even Saw and those kind of films. Yeah. You know, it takes a unique vision to really sort of generate some hype. And it's the thing about spiritualism, it's about possession, it's about horror. I mean, the thing that I always love about horror films, I've mentioned this before, Jaws is not about being afraid of a shark. It's about the fear of getting into the water.
Yeah.
Freddy Krueger is not about being afraid of the man with the knives. It is about your fear as a child of going to sleep. The monster that'll get you if you go to sleep. Camp in the woods. You're alone in the woods. Who's out there? And it's that primal fear that plays into people. And Exorcist just did that so, so well. It did actually blur its lines, though, between... what was suggested to be real and what is real, in terms of you mentioned some of the cast, and there is a notorious story about one of the members of the cast, Paul Bateson, who was hired as a radiographer. He was sort of one of the hospital assistants in one of the scenes where Reagan's getting the procedure on her neck. I think it's the first spinal tap she has. And there's a guy in there who's called Paul Bateson, and this is a long, long story. But this is a guy that grew up, he was in the army, stationed in Germany in the 60s, became an alcoholic, moved back to Pennsylvania. Then he lived in New York. He was in homosexual relationships. He was in that sort of scene in New York, the leather scene down in the sort of the fish market, whatever they call it.
Can we make a little sign? Leather.
And so he'd by 1973 he was working at the hospital, and he'd already been in The Exorcist at this point, and then he moved out to Brooklyn, and then he lost his job through drinking, became a cashier at a porn movie theater, and basically started cruising around these different bars. Now, during this time, during the 70s, there were a spate of murders in New York, in Manhattan and the area, called the Bag Murders. These were where dismembered body parts were found in body bags and suitcases, whatever, washed up in the Hudson River. None of the bodies were identified, all the causes of death, but the clothing was traced back, and the tattoos they had was traced back to the gay community in New York. It was around September 1977 when Variety film reporter Addison Verrill was found dead in his apartment. He was beaten and stabbed. No sign of force entry. And there were also beer cans and glasses and stuff. He was a regular around these clubs, especially in one called Mineshaft, a gay bar which opened until 6 a.m. I don't care which way your bread's buttered. That's some party in that.
6 a.m.?
Somebody tells me you're going to be out in a bar till 6 a.m. I don't care how good the music is. I'm not fucking going. 8 days after his murder, a fellow reporter received a phone call at his home. It was a gay rights activist who was basically telling him to be aware because there's somebody going out there killing writers and article writers and whoever. To cut a long story short, Paul Bateson was found to have been the murderer of Addison, and he was locked up. He was found with $57 in cash and the guy's ID, and basically ended up getting locked up and trialed and sent to prison for the murder. It was on while he was on being locked up that he's actually suggested to several cellmates that he's killed other people and put their parts in bags and thrown them into the Hudson. Now, no charges were ever brought against him as being the serial killer, the body bag murderer. But there's an awful lot that points towards this man being involved in more than just one murder.
You see, yes, I understand. I've read a bit about him. I've actually just popped up there to remind myself about him. And I was like, oh, fuck, I do actually remember reading about this case years ago. I'm hesitant to believe a lot of stuff about people. Now, I'm not saying it's true or it's false or whatever. Like, but it always reminds me about Henry Lee Lucas and how Henry Lee Lucas just admitted to everything just because he was addicted to coffee and he was addicted to chocolate. And cops from everywhere in fucking, in, you know, in America were coming around. And, do you remember this, Henry? Do you remember ever being in fucking Tennessee? Do you remember murdering anybody in Tennessee next to a road by a bridge? And double winking. This kind of gives me that kind of impression where anybody who was openly gay back in the day was kind of just blamed for anything that kind of happened in the gay community. I'm not saying he did, I'm not saying he didn't. If he had a fucking head in a duffel bag, then yeah, that's probably a wee bit fucking probably did do it. Like, but you know, what I always laugh at is, again, what you said there is, like, people always say fucking when gay people are out so late, fuck me, they're always partying at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Like, well, they kind of have to party at 3 o'clock in the morning because it's the only time that they can be themselves, you know.
Yeah.
It's the only time that, you know, where society that we live in now, which is fucked up, that doesn't judge them and doesn't fucking have to sit there and go, you know, they don't have to apologize for what they're doing. But again, geez, I could be an apologist for a serial killer here.
Sounds like you are.
It really does, doesn't it? I'm sorry. I don't even know my point.
It's their fault for going out at 3 a.m. Yeah.
That's Karen Pelican talking.
If they'd have just stayed at home.
If they'd have just stayed at home and had a few drinks in the living room and listened to fucking, you know, I was going to say Gloria Hunterford there. No, if this isn't the ABBA on the TV, you know, none of these serial killers would have happened.
So William Friedkin actually visited Paul Bates in prison on Rikers Island. Bateson spoke of his part in The Exorcist and said, "It was sort of a belated revenge on my father, since he would punish me by not allowing me to go to Saturday matinees when I was young. He'd made me stay at home and listen to opera on the radio." And Friedkin, who had been in conversation with Bateson, said, "Though Bateson worked with a brain surgeon, he himself was not a brain surgeon, because the body bags all had little indications that they were from NYU Medical Center, and that's how the police tracked him." Friedkin, however, and we've spoke about Friedkin's panache for hyping up a film's, you know, based on reality, and he went on to direct Al Pacino in the film Cruising.
Such a great movie as well. Very good movie.
Met with a lot of resistance by the gay community because of what they were doing and who they were filming.
Yeah, but I think it was met by a lot of resistance to everybody because it was one of the only kind of movies around that time that was kind of that was projecting like a gay ideology. And yes, I understand that the undertones of, you know, it has to be dark and seedy and fucking leather jackets and fucking underground. Like, I understand that doesn't sit well with a lot of gay people on it. Like, but I actually really enjoyed Cruising. Like, Karen Allen was in it as well. And Paul Sorvino was in it. Do you remember Paul Sorvino? Mira Sorvino's father. He was in it as well. I remember watching it years ago when I was going through. Everybody goes through their Al Pacino fucking fest. You know, they go through Scent of a Woman, hoo-ha! And then they go through Dog Day Afternoon and shit like that there. But I remember watching Cruising. I really, really enjoyed Cruising. I remember trying to justify it when it was, you know, like a 13-year-old growing up in Oma in County Tyrone about it. Yeah, you should really watch Cruising. What's it about? Well, it's a movie about a detective that goes undercover in a gay scene and stuff. Oh, you like gay things, do you? Then I.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was how it was for anything. Oh, I'm going to stick this on. What is it? It's Elton John. Oh,
yeah, that's right. He wasn't gay for like 10 years and then. Now you look at it and go, fuck off. Fuck off.
So Bateson was convicted on the 5th of March 1979 for the murder of Addison Verrill. And a month later, at his sentencing, the prosecutor called Bateson a psychopath and told the court that he believed Bateson was responsible for the six bodies found in the Hudson, despite a lack of proof. Bateson was sentenced to 20 years to life in prison and was transferred to Staten Island to serve out his sentence. The murders of the six men in the bags are still classified as unsolved, and their bodies have never been identified. Bateson's story was actually on the small screen in Mindhunter series season 2. I didn't actually click on, but then again, I can't even remember a point where they just said to each other, let's go speak to Bateson. How do we know him? Well, did you ever see The Exorcist? You know, the guy who was in...
Listen, don't bring up Mindhunter. Don't bring up Mindhunter. Don't talk about Mank. Because Mank is the reason that there is no future Mindhunter. And I'm too caught up about it. I'm just too caught up about it. I have watched Mindhunter season 1 and season 2 about 4 times.
It's fantastic.
It is simply the best TV show on Netflix, bar none.
And that's what Netflix do. Two seasons and get rid of it and get something else in. Paul Bateson was released from Arthur Kill Correction Facility in Staten Island in August 2003. He was 63 at the time. He served his parole and disappeared, with many believing he is now dead.
Or is he?
Yeah, he's probably pushing 80s. Yeah, he's probably dead
probably,
by now.
Probably dead, yeah. Probably
so, look, dead. So let's put the evidence together, shall we? We had a fire on the set that didn't set fire to the room where the exorcism was taking place.
Because the temperature was low.
We had many of the cast and their families who have either died or been in accidents in the years after the film.
Yeah, many years after the film, because they're old, yeah.
We had Linda Blair and Ellen Burstyn receiving injuries on set.
Yeah, because William freaking was a maniac and he shot shotguns, you know, in a room, yeah.
And we've also had a serial killer who was hired by the director.
Potential serial killer. Yes, people have convicted him. Yes, 100%, but maybe, yeah.
And of course, the fact that Billy Graham actually told us the actual film this film was printed on was cursed because of the hysteria and the vomiting and the fainting of the audiences when this film first came out.
Who, the Reverend Billy Graham?
Yeah.
Is this the guy who like stole millions of dollars from his people, and then I'm almost sure his son potentially is a paedophile? What? I said potentially. I didn't say in fact actually is.
Everyone's a potential pig. Have you ever seen Shirley Valentine? Can't believe we're going for The Exorcist. Where's the woman who's been scorned by her husband? She sat there and she just, the first thing she turns to Shirley and just goes, all men are potential rapists. Okay, so what you're trying to say is we've just wasted the last 40 minutes.
Not really, because I actually watched The Exorcist again about a week ago, and it is sublime.
Yeah.
And do you know what? And do you know what? It actually reminds me as well of William Friedkin. And it would like, I genuinely, I was sitting there, and me and Rachel watched, we watched The Exorcist, and I just thought to myself, I've got to watch French Connection again. Like, I've got to watch The French Connection again. And I watched it about 2 nights ago, and I will say this, if you haven't watched The French Connection, if The French Connection is just something you haven't even thought about, if you've never heard of it, if you haven't seen it in years, just fucking watch The French Connection, because there are a few films in life that just give you ultimate pleasure, and The French Connection for me is one of them. It is gritty, it is dirty, it is fucking New York, it is Popeye Doyle, it's Gene Hackman at his absolute best, it is the greatest fucking car chase that you will ever see in your entire life, which was shot live on the fucking streets. Just fantastic. Utter joy.
Have you seen the two prequels to this? We're not going to talk about the sequels. Jesus. Have you seen the prequels to this, where basically that's another part of the curse, apparently. They paid one guy to make a prequel to The Exorcist. And it was absolute dog shit. So they hired another guy to do it, and that was absolute dog shit as well. So they just released both. It was like the Snyder Cut before the Snyder Cut was popular.
I do remember watching something with Alexander Skarsgård in it.
Yeah, that was it.
And it had like an exorcist kind of theme to it. Yeah. And like the only thing I can remember is like thinking that it's like an U-Ball movie.
No, that was a genuine. The first one was, I think it was the first one, Dominion. The Dominican Republic.
It was the Puerto Rican version I want to see rather than the Dominican one.
So the first one was Exorcist the Beginning, which was directed by Rennie Harlan. And then they said that's absolute dog shit. So they got Paul Schrader.
Rennie Harlan.
Did they
actually let him make a movie after Cutthroat Island?
Well, yeah, they did. And basically they said, no, this is absolute shit. So they had somebody come in and just take a little bit of it and basically remake the entire film again. I'd be interested in comparing the two versions one day, but not today. So are we saying categorically the film's not cursed?
I would pretty much say categorically it's not. There's too much in the no category than there is in the yes category. Unless you're gonna drop out now and just give it the fucking well, Corbic. Here we go. I've got actual film footage proof that it is cursed. Here it is. Here we go, Paul. Ready to go. Let's go now.
Thanks, everybody. See you next time. Oh, what are we doing on? I've got nothing for you. What's our next dark dessert going to be then?
Do you know what I'd like? Well, his movies aren't that bad. Come on,
he is though.
he's terrible. Maybe Fatty Arbuckle.
You want to go with Fatty?
Maybe. Or maybe even Chaplin. I like that silent era.
Do we have like a Christmassy one? Because it'll be coming up to Christmas by the time we do. What's a Christmas dark dessert?
How Santa rips.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that. Thanks very much, everybody. See you next time on our dark desserts. Thank you. Bye bye.
William Peter Blatty, the writer of The Exorcist, came across a story of a little boy who was possessed.
The Catholic Church regards that case as one of the very few authentic cases of demonic possession in this country.
That was the basis for The Exorcist. Of course, it changed the little boy to a little girl. But at the end of the day, The Exorcist was based on fact.
It is strange that movies that have to do with the occult will have spooky or strange things happen to the actors and to the crew on set. Linda Blair experienced accidents.
I was definitely challenged by the physicality, fractured my lower back, but it was something that I was able to compartmentalize. One day there was a fire on a set.
The set burned to the ground. And we had no idea why.
And there was a lot of speculation as to what could it have been.
For some mysterious reason, the bedroom where the devil possesses Linda Blair's character Reagan was the only part of the set untouched by flames.
After the Exorcist fires, they had the set blessed.
A lot of people want to believe more in the curiosity, the dark side, the possibility, could it have been? And then there were others that were more apt to say, no, it's just an electrical short that happened. But a lot of people kept certain things away from me because they would never want to do anything that would scare me from going back on set.
It's something that a lot of people have called cursed with good reason.
Everything has to do with the mystery of fate or faith. And The Exorcist is about the mystery of faith. I knew exactly how I wanted to make it. I marked up my own copy of the hardcover. I didn't want any backstory, no flashbacks, just a straight-ahead story that was done as realistically as possible. And over the decades, it's been interpreted and reinterpreted. Many people look at the ending of the film as ambiguous. Doesn't appear to have been a problem for the millions of people who've seen the film. They accept what we showed. it asks for a total leap of faith on the part of the audience.
It's really gross.
Did it upset you?
Yeah.
It was really terrific.
I can't even think. I can't even talk.
Like my heart beat too fast.
I've never in my life known a movie where people would faint. I mean, it's hard to make people faint. Well, as soon as they faint, I get out smelling salts.
And my devil coming out of her.
I'm gonna stay here for the rest of the movie.
You're not gonna go back?
No, I'm too scared. I never get scared. I am too scared.
I believe. I believe.
This is the second time we've seen it. We still can't hack it.
I can't even describe it. It's horrible.